Hello and welcome to another episode of Gemstone Mine. I'm John.
And I'm Jake.
And there was an awkward silence there in between us. Alex is not able to join us today. He just figured out this great new idea for a deck he is calling Scoot Swarm Storm, and he is still trying to resolve his triggers. He will be back again next time, but for now, we're going to try to go on ahead without him.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah.
Our topic for today is another lesson from CEDH. CEDH is a metagame within the Commander format that sits at one extreme with highly consistent and highly efficient decks. Not all cards are equally powerful in all formats, or even in all metagames, but there are lessons to be learned from how people are brewing with the most powerful cards in our game. And the cards we're going to talk about this time are wheel effects. The question we want to try to answer today is, when is it the right time to use one of these powerful cards? But before we get to that, we got a little bit of news to talk about today. Jake, you've been following along with the development of the deck building website Moxfield, and you've got an update for us on some new features that have come out recently.
Yeah, I'm a Patreon supporter for Moxfield because I really enjoy that website and all the stuff that that team's doing. And the other day, Harry posted in the Discord that there's a new feature for adding cards to your deck in a quick add feature. So that's gone live now, and if you are ever in the deck building part of Moxfield, there's a little lightning bolt icon you can click on, and it's a drop-down menu that will just give you options to add basic lands, add rainbow lands, crowd lands, shock lands, everything like that, and it's tied to the color identity of your commander, so it's a pretty quick way to just build out your mana base without having to remember the name of all the different battle bond land names and all that stuff. And then there's also a feature down at the bottom to add CEDH staples, and it will, again, look at your, the color identity of your commander and just dump a list of cards that are considered staples. This is a list created and maintained by the user Null Mage, and he has that hosted on Moxfield, and Harry is referencing that. So that's a pretty cool way to quickly build out a deck that you're messing around with, or to see what different options are for your mana base.
I, for one, always kind of cringe when I have to go to build my mana base. It is the most time-consuming part of brewing a deck for me, just trying to remember the names of all the different lands and which order they are the most useful in, and trying to make those decisions. Just having a button to push, this may be the feature that gets me moving over to Moxfield for my brewing. I'm still waiting for Moxfield to have actual inventory management, but otherwise, this is moving along in the direction I like, particularly as they have, as you mentioned before, recently introduced the visual building, like just laying out cards like stacks on your table, something I really enjoyed.
Yeah, and for the mana base building, honestly, when I am making a deck, I will go and find someone else's deck that just happens to be the same color identity and roughly the same curve of mine, and just copy and paste their mana base, tweak it if necessary, but yeah, I can never remember the names of all the different, especially like the New Orleans, the Battle Bond crowd lands or whatever they're called. And yeah, it's convenient to have just one button click to populate your mana base and tweak it from there.
Absolutely. Now, the other interesting piece of news you posted this morning looks like it is some early packaging art for the Innistrad set from this fall. And the packaging is pretty on the nose for vampires and werewolves. Not a lot of information about the set itself, but that's a vampire, that's a werewolf.
Yep. There's going to be set boosters and draft boosters and collector boosters. I'm sure this is groundbreaking news that nobody would have thought before. But yeah, so Innistrad. It's going to have Innistrad-y things.
It will. Well, if there's no other news, why don't we get into some games that we've played? Jake, have you managed to get any games in since last we talked?
No, not yet. Hoping to maybe later today jam a couple games, but still have not put any actual cards into play yet.
Well, we did our formal housewarming party for Alex's house, the whole three people who were there. We were nice and socially distanced for our whole time together. We were masked up, but we did manage to break open some of the Kaldheim pre-release kits where Alex firmly stomped us into the ground. Then we split a box of Commander Legends, so we did 8-pack sealed. Made some pretty fun decks out of that.
God, that's kind of bonkers.
I wound up putting together a deck with the Black-White Angel from that set, who you instead of paying the commander tax, you pay 2 life for each time you would pay the commander tax for her. And then she drains someone for 2 anytime they cast any spell. But she has flying and lifelink, so big beater angel who won't stay dead proved to be fairly effective in that game. It did turn into a game of trying to steal slash remove slash keep her off the field. But in the end, big beater angel did the job. We also got to play a handful of games of just good old-fashioned Commander. Our friend of the show, Luke, shout out to our buddy Luke down here in Florida, managed to break out his Brago deck for the first time in a long time. Alex broke out his Akiri deck. This is the first time I got to see that deck in action. It was about a half step behind where it really wanted to be, but there is some pretty nasty potential for explosiveness with that deck. I was pretty worried seeing early Sigarda's Aid come down, and that has the potential to do some very stupid things very quickly for just cheating around mana costs on Swords of Win the game, Swords of X and Y. But I did manage to score 2 wins that day with my Tribal Cleric's Aura deck, where it turns out that just being that half step ahead and getting the value engine set up was enough to just start looping. There is a cleric from Zendikar Rising that when it enters the battlefield, it will force everybody to eat an edict effect, a sacrifice effect, like Fleshbrag Marauder. And just being able to recur that endlessly meant that my opponents couldn't keep their key pieces on the field. Fun game
that
for me.
That seems pretty useful. Plus, I know it's basically a cleric scrap trawler deck, and we all know how you feel about those.
Well, the name of the deck is Sacrament Trawler.
God. Yeah, I have not played against this deck yet, and I am looking forward to it.
All right, now, speaking of decks I'm looking forward to, Jake, our decks we're building, decks we're tweaking, is literally all you. So just go ahead.
Okay, so a while ago I had a Hapatra deck, and I've been kind of tweaking it and updating it, and I decided to give a try on Cobblepot. Labmaniac and the Mind Sculptor fame has come up with a tech that he calls Shadow Bag, and it's kind of ridiculous. Basically, it involves drawing a ridiculous number of cards and discarding them to fuel Bone Miser, which is a 5 mana black creature. It's basically a Waste Knot, but for you. So when you discard a land, you get mana. When you discard a creature, you get a zombie. When you discard a non-creature non-land, you draw a card. And then it uses Bag of Holding and Shadow of the Grave to basically let you rebuy all your discarded cards back to your hand and do it again. So it's kind of like a build-your-own ad nauseum type of thing. It has a lot of moving parts. It's really kind of weird, but also really cool. So I have ported some of that into Hapatra, and we'll see. It may be terrible, and I don't think I'm smart enough to run it, but I'm going to try it.
It sounded like you were having some success with it when you were goldfishing it the other night.
Yeah, I did do a couple rounds of goldfishing. It is really cool when it works, but it also kind of reminds me of some of the old manual storm lists that I made you sit through as I very awkwardly tried to figure out how to actually close the game out. So we'll see how it goes.
So you've got some other things that are on the workbench, as it were.
Yes, my showcase Orvar came in. So I am working on a mono blue Orvar deck, which is cool. It's one of those decks that, or it's one of those commanders rather, that makes a lot of older kind of garbage cards actually have a purpose. Things like Twiddle and just any of those one CMC derpy old blue spells. Whim of Volrath is one of note. It is a buyback instant that doesn't really do anything, but it has spiked up to, I think, like $35 or something, and it was just a bulk rare before Orvar was printed.
Old is old.
Yes, but basically it's going to be mono blue ramp, making a whole bunch of islands and mana rocks and doing high tide things. It has the potential to like dump out a whole bunch of Rhystic Studies, so that's fun. One Rhystic Study is good, but how about 5 Rhystic Studies?
Did you pay,
the
5?
Yeah.
And then you've got another deck you are trying to, you're trying to assemble, brew, tweak?
Yeah, this is mostly just me going, hey, those Tevish Zot Krom decks are really cool and look ridiculous and super explosive. I should probably get one of those.
I can confirm that Krom is amazing, and I cannot wait to build a Tevish Zot list myself.
If anybody is listening and is not already watching the Mind Sculptors gameplay videos, there was a recent one that came out that really highlights the explosivity of Tevishizat and Krom. Actually, they have a couple on their channel that have highlighted this.
It turns out that when one of your commanders is a planeswalker who upticks to protect himself and can still uptick to draw you additional cards while getting around almost all of the usual stacks effects in the format, that can be very powerful.
Yeah, it's really wild because I remember when the set came out and, you know, everybody does their set reviews. Nobody was really talking about Tevishizat. And I didn't even think it was good. I opened one of the alternate art ones in my box. I'm like, oh, well, that sucks.
Well, now you get to use it.
A 5 CMC Planeswalker. Planeswalkers are just not very good traditionally in Commander because there's just like the action economy of Planeswalkers versus other spells. It's less backbreaking than in like 1v1 games. But you did mention he has 2+1s or 2+ abilities.
A plus two makes
2 chump blockers for you,
mm-hmm.
which are also sack fodder for all these black decks that want to run like Culling the Weak or Diabolic Intent.
Or for Tevishizat.
Draws cards.
Two cards for sacrificing any creature, including one of those Thrall tokens. 3 for sacrificing a commander.
And it's not unreasonable to actually get his ultimate off because of how resilient the commander is. And one thing I didn't even really notice until somebody pointed it out. If you ult Tevishizat and he dies, the ult goes off and you still get him back because he's in your command
zone. For free. And then you get to use him again.
Yeah, it's
ridiculous. So you can just immediately feed him one of the commanders you stole.
But yeah, if you mentioned an upcoming CEDH type of deck, like a whole archetype built around 2 5-CMC partners that would seem a little out of place in the past, but now it's just awesome. I love it.
I'm pretty excited about it too. Tevishizat caught my interest mostly because he is a source of card advantage in the command zone. He has partner, which means you can stick him as a partner with a white plus another color partner, and then you have access to a way to break parity on humility. And that is one of the decks I have been slowly working on, but emphasis on slowly.
Oh, God.
Just like the gameplay will be.
Humility.
Well, why don't we shift gears then from the more powerful stuff in CEDH to some lessons we can learn from CEDH. Let's start with trying to describe what a wheel even is.
All right, so wheels are named after the iconic card Wheel of Fortune, which first appeared in Alpha. So this is going all the way back to Magic's origin. If you're unfamiliar, Wheel of Fortune is a red sorcery. It costs 2 generic and 1 red. And the text is simply, each player discards his or her hand and draws 7 cards. So there are multiple variations of this effect. Some were even printed alongside of Wheel of Fortune in Alpha. But the normal knobs that are used to tweak this effect are things like mana cost, what happens with the cards from your hand, whether or not you're discarding them or shuffling them into your library, how many cards are drawn, who draws the cards, that kind of stuff. So there's probably a dozen or so variants of wheels of varying degrees of playability out there by now.
For a long time, especially outside of CDH, we looked at them as one of the few ways that red could actually draw cards. And the prohibitive expense of a lot of the wheel effects that did exist meant that, well, red was always in kind of a bad way outside of CDH. And yeah, honestly, in CDH as well, it was pretty bad for a while. But as we've seen more and more of these wheel effects come out, it has changed the math a little bit. So what does a wheel actually do? I think the most important and most obvious effect of the wheel is that it will reload your hand. Obviously, hopefully, after you've emptied it, going from 0 cards to 7 cards is a really powerful effect. And probably the one that most people look at when they see a wheel in their hand and say, ooh, I could draw 7 cards right now. But there's more to a wheel than that.
Yeah, some of the other things that are worth taking into consideration is the effect it has on other players. So it can disrupt their own hand sculpting that they've been doing. if you have an opponent who has drawn a whole bunch of cards, you can force them to get back on an even footing with you and the rest of the table.
And it's also sometimes useful in more out-there effects. We don't see a lot of them these days, but especially outside of CDH, graveyard strategies are usually very fun. And wheels have the effect of not just getting you more cards, but also filling up your graveyard, which may take the time where you don't really care if you do have a full grip, because you would be much happier if Razakath or some other giant monster is in your graveyard instead of stuck in your hand.
Yeah, if you could leverage your graveyard, discarding your hand into your graveyard is basically just making your hand even bigger. So that is a pretty potent effect for those decks that treat the graveyard as basically an extension of their hand. And then, more commonly these days, you use wheels as part of a combo piece. There are a bunch of cards that have been printed recently that trigger off of opponents' drawing cards. One of the newer, more recent ones is Hull Breacher. We'll get into more of these later, but you combine one of the many wheel effects with one of the many wheel payoffs, and you have a bunch of redundant combos in your deck that you can take advantage of to push yourself far ahead while at the same time really hampering your opponents.
And we will go into more details on the payoffs in a bit, but this is a really important part to consider when you are including wheels in your deck and when you're trying to decide when is the right time to wheel. So what are the downsides that wheels have? They seem like they do a lot of really great things for us, but part of the, I guess, the chaos that wheels bring to the table is that they also have upsides for your opponents too. What's the first big upside that wheels have for our opponents?
So most of the wheel effects are symmetrical, and you have to keep that in mind. When you're refilling your own hand, you're also going to be refilling the hands of your three other opponents. And I'm not great at math, but I'm pretty sure 21 is a larger number than 7. So that is a lot more new cards introduced on your opponent's side than your own side.
It also has the possibility that if you have an opponent who is on a graveyard strategy, they could be the ones who are happily dumping giant dragons or zombies or whatever into their graveyard and smiling all the way. Just like mill strategies outside of CDH can sometimes be very double-edged swords, depending on which side of the table you're sitting on from the graveyard deck, so too can wheel effects have that same type of problem.
Yeah, you don't want to wheel and then watch your opponent smile and throw, like, a Golgari Grave Troll in his graveyard or whatever. Another thing is that you are the one playing the wheel, which means you are having to actually spend the resources, the mana, and the card from your hand in order to cast it. So unless you are capable of immediately taking advantage of it, your opponents are going to be able to take their turns with a fresh grip of cards and all of their resources available before you can.
Right, you're going to be down, for most of these cards, 3 mana before you get to untap with that fresh hand. Your opponents will theoretically be able to untap with the same fresh grip of cards that you just handed them. So it's a tough thing trying to figure out how you're going to actually do your wheel and when to wheel and when it is the correct time to wheel.
Yeah, the title of this episode is When to Wheel, and I'm going to go ahead and ruin it, and we're not going to tell you exactly, like, rules of thumb for always making sure you wheel at the correct time, but we will be bringing up a lot of different topics to consider and different situations where it would be good to keep in mind so that you can make more informed choices.
Right. There is no, I mean, a peek behind the curtain. Jake and I spent probably over an hour the other night just trying to talk about this episode and how we were going to put it together. And I asked, so is there any way that we can do this kind of like a mulligan and talk about, so if you have these cards, is it correct to wheel or not? But then we're sitting there going, we're going to have to then figure out what cards are going to be on the field for our opponents, how many cards they're going to have in hand, how much mana they're going to have open, how much mana we're going to have open, what the deck compositions look like, who's going to be able to play mana more easily off of the wheel, and...
Yeah, it's so contextual. I guess before we get into the details, the main takeaway I would like to say is that just because you have it in your hand and you can cast it does not mean that it is right to play it immediately.
That's a really good way to put it. The timing of the wheel I think impacts upon its power significantly. I have got to learn quite a bit about when the ideal time to wheel is, but I've also been playing Opus Thief, a deck that was built specifically to take advantage of wheels and break the whole parity on those and the symmetry on those in very strong ways.
I just thought of this, but one way of trying to evaluate wheels is to treat them less of a card draw spell and treat it more like Wrath of God. It is a symmetrical effect, but you're not really playing those cards when it would be symmetrical. You're not going to have a full board of creatures and play Wrath of God. You're going to play it when your opponents have a strong lead over you, or there's just something in particular you need to use that card for.
I think that is a really good example, and I think we should use that as we go forward talking about when the correct time to wheel is in a few different very basic scenarios that we've put together for this. Before we do that, though, why don't we talk about some of the other key wheel effects for us to look at? We talked about Wheel of Fortune, the original and probably the simplest, the card that gives the entire category of wheels their names. There is another very powerful wheel effect in the history of Magic, where one of the knobs that they tweak on it is that it does not really fuel graveyard strategies, but fuels different strategies in some very powerful ways. So what is the million-dollar wheel, Jake?
So you did say power a lot. This is the only piece of Power 9 that is legal in Commander. Time Twister. It is a blue sorcery for 2 generic and a blue. Each player shuffles his or her hand and graveyard into his or her library and draws 7 cards. Yeah, this does not fuel discard strategies.
Well, it doesn't fuel graveyard strategies. It still does trigger discards. Oh, no, it does not.
No, it
you're
does
right.
Not. It, yep.
Ooh, you're right. I yes. learn something new every day.
So it is actually an anti-graveyard card, which will strip everyone's graveyards away. You can use it in that manner. You can also use it to do Time Twister loops, where you're basically shuffling your graveyard back into your library, drawing your cards, and repeating that process.
And just recurring the Time Twister from your graveyard with, whether they be regrowth type effects, whether they be effects that can cast a spell out of your graveyard, or whatever. The fact is, Time Twister doesn't exile itself when you use it.
Yes. Turns out, it is a strong card.
It is extremely strong.
There's actually other... They've kind of played around for a while trying to find the color identity for this effect. There's a lot of them in blue, there's a couple in red, but I think there's one other blue one that is a really key card to discuss in this.
And I think the card you're referring to there is Windfall. So Windfall is another blue sorcery for 2 and a blue. Each player discards his or her hand and draws cards equal to the greatest number of cards a player discarded this way. It basically says whoever has the most, everyone discards and then goes up to that number.
So Windfall is especially good when you're using it as like a disruption piece, because then you get more of the payoff of it. It's just important to keep in mind that it is not a fixed 7. It is going to be dependent on who has the most cards at the table. There's some fancy stuff you can do with that. Like if you can get most of your deck in your hand and then play Windfall, you can make everybody else draw their deck and potentially lose because they don't have enough cards in their deck.
There's a lot of weird things you can do with Windfall. It also kind of illustrates a lot of the strategy behind wheeling just in the way the card is designed.
All right, so now that we've talked about what wheels actually are and have gone over a little bit of their strengths and weaknesses, I guess we should finally address the topic of the show, and when should you wheel?
And I honestly think that Windfall is the perfect card to just illustrate the basics, the strengths and weaknesses of when you want to do your wheels. And the question you should be asking is very similar, Jake, to the one that you posed. Treating it like a wrath for someone's hand, as opposed to being a card draw spell, is a very powerful way to look at it. Because you're looking at when are you going to be most likely to break parity on it. Windfall, as I've said, has the unique effect that it is basically begging you to break parity on the spell and be able to go ahead and pick the opportune time when you are low on cards and your opponents are up on cards. So in that scenario where you say, I'm low on cards, my opponents have lots of cards, a wheel effect such as Windfall will disrupt your opponents, it will reload your hand. If your opponents have been tutoring to hand or tutor to top deck and then drew that card, so they've been sculpting their hand, is usually the way we would say this. Can also rein in a player who has gotten way ahead on cards. That person has been sitting there for the whole round of the table on Rhystic Study and Consecrated Sphinx and is smiling with his 17 cards in hand, and then you throw down your Windfall and say, us two. It also is very powerful to reload your hand, and it is particularly powerful, as we've learned from CEDH, when you're able to combine it with very cheap sources of mana that you can use immediately. You mentioned that one of the costs that you have to pay when you're the person who's pulling the trigger to wheel is you are literally the person paying the mana cost for it. When your deck is going to then reward you for that wheel with more mana sources that you can immediately take advantage of, that is one of the most powerful times to wheel. So a deck that's going to be more low to the ground and have more powerful mana rocks or rituals or similar types of effects tends to be the decks that can take the most advantage of wheels. Not only are you more likely to be the person who has emptied their hand out more quickly, but you're also the person who is going to be in the best position after a wheel to develop and to utilize those cards that you just drew.
Yeah, I've noticed there's actually a lot of similarity when you're building your deck between trying to be able to take advantage of wheels and something like an Ad Nauseam style deck. I know I'm the weirdo that likes to play Ad Nauseam in my casual decks, but the idea of just being able to, at some point in the game, expect to have a sudden influx of cards, but be able to do something with them. So you really don't want to Windfall into a 17-card hand and then go, okay, go to cleanup step, discard 10 cards. You want to be able to do something with that resource that is now in your grip. This leads to including stuff like maybe you want to play Lotus Petal and Dark Ritual, Elvish Spirit Guide, any of these cards that when they're in your hand, you can immediately turn them into mana to play the other cards in your hand and get a nice chain going so that you can take advantage of the new resources that you have been so graciously gifted by yourself.
And a lot of these are not particularly expensive effects. Fortunately, Dark Ritual has been printed several times. It does limit you to black, but there have been rituals printed in other colors. In blue, you can look at something like High Tide. In red, red has kind of become the new color for rituals, and we got a particularly powerful one out of Commander Legends in Jeska's Wheel. Will.
Got wheels on the brain. Yes, yeah. Jeska's Wheel is a fantastic card. It is, especially if you're going to play it after Windfalling for 17. And like John was mentioning, a lot of these cards, some of these cards are fairly cheap. Some of the cards are a little expensive. You know, Time Twister has got a price tag on it. Wheel of Fortune also is going up. But I will take this moment to encourage everyone to allow proxying in your groups, because then you get to play with really cool cards and everyone gets to have fun.
I've got no problems with my opponents bringing proxies over so we can have a good game on even footing.
Yes, I know that not everybody has been playing this game since 1994, like a couple of us, and I definitely prefer to play against decks rather than wallets.
Absolutely. It's more fun to play the game.
So another use that we hinted at earlier is breaking parity on the wheel. This is when you're, like for the analogy of playing a Wrath of God, this is after you sacrifice all your creatures to Ashnod's Altar or something along those lines. This will be utilizing cards such as Hull Breacher, which is one of the newer cards for two generic and a blue. It's a 3/2 Merfolk Pirate with Flash. If an opponent would draw a card, except for the first one they draw in each of their draw steps, instead, you create a treasure token. So this is turning all of your wheels into mind twists for all of your opponents, so they have to discard their entire hand. They don't draw anything back, but you get a whole bunch of mana to run with your new cards.
As we just mentioned, being the first person who has access to those new cards with lots of mana to take advantage of them, that is a potent recipe right there.
And often that is enough to put you in a substantial lead of the game, where you make everyone discard 4 to 7 cards, you refill your hand, you have a ton of mana, you're in a pretty good spot.
Absolutely. I will say that I think that Hull Breacher is probably the most powerful payoff, the most powerful thing you can be doing proactively when you are planning to break parity on a wheel. There have been a number of other ones printed, from the original payoff with Notion Thief, to cards like Smothering Tithe and Alms Collector, Narset, Parter of Veils is notoriously powerful, even newer cards like Tegrid, older cards like Waste Not, and the old standby Consecrated Sphinx all break parity on wheel effects in very powerful ways, and each of them in a fairly unique way as well. There's some subtlety between when you want to throw a wheel out for each of these cards, depending on which one you happen to have access to. Each one has its own real time to pay you off. Each one is going to give you its own benefits. For example, Tegrid is only going to be a really big payoff if your opponents happen to have a lot of permanents in hand. So maybe you want to combine Tegrid and a wheel with something like a end of turn Cyclonic Rift, just to put everyone else's creatures back to their hand so you can get all of those juicy targets.
That's pretty evil. And yeah, it's interesting to look at all of the different payoffs that have been printed. They're all slightly different, and all of the wheels are slightly different, so they have a lot of unique interactions. One pretty nice thing is that there are so many of these effects in the last couple years that you can reliably make this a deck plan.
And that was actually the genesis of the deck Opus Thief, which is one of my personal favorite CEDH decks and kind of my pet CEDH deck. The idea behind which being that there was now enough wheels and wheel payoff cards that you could reliably build a deck around the game plan of, I am going to try to slam down a payoff, I am going to cast a wheel, break parity on it, and get ahead on the back of that wheel, and then hopefully chain wheels together to such point that I can draw into my win conditions while my parity breaking effects are keeping my opponents from being able to interact with me.
I do remember when Shaper Savant first made that deck list, and it was such a cool idea. I think it was when Smothering Tithe was printed, right?
Correct. So Smothering Tithe was when he said that now is the time we have a critical mass. Later we got Narset, and that just pushed it even further. And it's just gotten better and better with the printing of cards like Hull Breacher. Unfortunately, in CEDH, now almost everybody is on Hull Breacher, so almost everybody can disrupt the now-named Wheel Thief archetype. But yeah, it is still a powerful deck.
It is. It has become, I don't know if it's less of its own unique archetype now, more than it's just a package that a lot of decks can include, because the opportunity cost is so low. And again, since there's more of these cards, it's a lot easier to fit them in whatever your color identity is. Like the original Opus Thief pretty much needed to be four colors to get enough of these effects.
Right.
But now you can, like a mono blue deck can run enough effects to make it a worthwhile inclusion. You've got Hull Breacher, Narset, Part of Veils, Windfall, Time Twister. And that's just picking the really good ones of all those versions. There's a ton of other blue effects or blue wheels that are maybe more expensive mana-wise or slightly less effective, but there's enough effects to be able to slot this into pretty much any deck that is running blue or red or any of these other color combinations.
I will say as a public service announcement that one of the other things you should learn when this is how you're planning to use your wheels is you want to have a way to make sure that once you leapfrog ahead of your opponents and either leave them empty-handed with nothing to do or put yourself that far ahead, it is a good idea to make sure you can close out the game in a reasonable time frame. In CEDH, commonly, these wheel decks would use a combination of Thassa's Oracle and Demonic Consultation in order to, ideally, win the game on the spot. It's not a whole lot of fun to sit there empty-handed while someone looks at their hand of new seven cards and then says, okay, I pass.
Yeah, it's the same concept as a lot of these symmetrical-ish effects. Like, don't play Armageddon just to play Armageddon. Make sure you have a backup or a path to victory from that point.
And a lot of these payoffs that we mentioned are potential paths to victory from it, but you want to make sure that when you are building a deck around wheels, that you include that as a key part of your game plan and see how they're going to then leapfrog you ahead into the win condition that you are trying to achieve. We mentioned before, outside of CDH, graveyard decks, reanimation decks, these are still powerful ways to build your deck. So you may want to consider doing something with the graveyard. If you have a bunch of big giant monsters you're going to throw into your graveyard, well, it doesn't cost a lot of mana to then cast Reanimate. It costs one black mana, in fact, to cast Reanimate. And it's not that hard to imagine a scenario where here comes Villis, Broker of Blood, or here comes Razaketh the Foul-Blooded, or, man, these demons really like blood, don't they?
It's like a cocktail, I think.
Well, when we were trying to scratch our heads and decide when else to consider wheeling, one scenario we do have to kind of pay heed to is my window to victory is closing. My only chance to win the game is to see a new hand of cards right now, and I have the adequate resources to make use of those cards right now. This may be a late game board stall where the only chance you have is to try to wheel and Hail Mary.
Yeah, if you know that there is an answer in your deck, you just need to dig for it, then wheels can often help you do a lot of digging. If there's a giant board, like John mentioned, somebody went, I don't know, infinite with Squirrel Farm. So there's a bunch of tapped squirrels and you're just like dead next turn. And you know you have Toxic Deluge or Damnation or whatever in your deck, and you just have to get to it, then this would be a good way to grab a hand of cards and hope you can pull something out of it.
One important thing to note with this, though, is that this is basically only reloading your hand. The disruptive elements are fairly minimal. You're not really going to be able to get the payoffs from triggering your draw or discard effects, and you're not really loading up anything for a future turn. You are literally just throwing a Hail Mary, which strips much of the strength away from wheels. It is really cool that wheels are still potentially effective in this desperation scenario, but I think it's important to recognize that this is a desperation scenario. Most of the time, you should be trying to develop your game plan to the point where you are staying out of that desperation scenario and trying to guide the game in a direction where you will be trying to break parity on wheels instead. And Jake, that kind of brings me to a question. You have in the past used some of the terminology we see in CDH, where people are describing counterspells, for example, as being better on the proactive side or on the defensive side. Would you say that there is a difference between a proactive wheel and a reactive or a defensive wheel?
Yeah, definitely. So along the lines that we were talking about earlier with the payoffs, you could use one of these payoffs and a wheel, and that would be a very proactive move to push your game plan forward. And when you're trying to use it as a disruption effect, that would be more of a reactive type of effect. And it's ideal if you can make it both. So if you're able to use your payoffs and disrupt people at the same time, that's just accruing so much advantage that will really help your game state.
That's a really good way to summarize it. So in summary then, why don't we just go through? A really good way to think of your wheel is like a wrath effect for people's hands. You're going to be trying to cast that when you have the opportunity to break parity on it. It's much less effective if you're casting your wrath and you are setting yourself back as much as you are setting your opponents back, and you are benefiting your opponents just as much as you are benefiting yourself. Having the ability to break parity on these wheels is something that we've seen be extremely effective at CEDH tables, and this is a powerful lesson to bring from those CEDH tables to less powerful tables. Finally, recognizing that wheels have many different avenues to victory. The ability to disrupt your opponents, reload your hand, and to fuel your own game plan. Recognizing when the wheel is able to check all of those boxes is probably going to point you to when it is the ideal time to wheel. And for the archetypal wheel that you can use to try to teach yourself this lesson, at a reasonable dollars and cents cost to actually own the card and put it in your deck, Windfall is a really good lesson to look towards for this.
Even without using proxies, it is not an insurmountable cost to add Windfall, Narset, Parter of Veils, and Hull Breacher into a deck, and that is going to do a lot for your game plan if you're able to cast these cards.
And that's about all we have on the subject of wheels. Well, there's probably a lot more that we could talk about with wheels. I mean, I guess we could...
We could talk about the best wheel you could ever do is when you're going turn one, dump your entire hand full of mana rocks and cast a wheel, and then just gleefully laugh as everyone who is agonized over their mulligans has to throw them all back and start over with probably a worse hand.
I mean, I've done that. I did play Opus Thief. It was such a good feeling when I went down to two cards in hand, one of which was a wheel, and wheeled and cackled maniacally. Good times were had by one.
And fun in Magic is a zero sum. So if no one else is having fun, that means you are having all of the fun.
This coming from the man who once played a turn one Sire of Insanity against us. I miss you, buddy.
It worked.
Well, we don't have a full crew today for a proper hot seat, but Jake and I have both been watching a series recently, and we're going to geek out about it for just a couple of minutes while we wind this episode down. Jake, I haven't seen the new episode of WandaVision yet. Is it good?
I enjoyed it. So I am not like the biggest comic geek, but I mean, I am a living individual, so I'm aware of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I do watch those movies and shows. When I heard about WandaVision, I was like, okay, I'll try it out. And the first couple episodes were really freaking weird, but it's really engaging. I'm enjoying it. It's way different than any of the other entries, like in the movies, and I really like it. It's really cool.
I've really been enjoying it as well. I'm seeing a lot of similarities between this and storylines from Marvel, like Avengers Disassembled, House of M. I'm even seeing some really weird vibes from The Visions, which was almost like The Vision builds his own family and then American Beauty happens. It was a weird freaking series, but it was also really cool. And this has been a really neat show to watch. As somebody who, among other things, you know, there wasn't much to watch on TV, so you'd watch Nick at Night, and you'd catch old episodes of I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched. And to see the first episode of WandaVision aping that three fixed camera style so beautifully, down to dangling plates from almost visible wires hanging from the top of the set. And then the throwbacks to the Dick Van Dyke Show. Oh, God. It really is super, super cool. And I'm enjoying the heck out of this. I can't wait to see the new episode or where they're going to wind up going with this. It looks like they're doing a lot of work to set up the next stage of the Marvel movies on the back of this show.
Yeah, I honestly don't have any clue where it's going. I've heard that there's been some leaks and stuff, but I've managed to avoid any of that. So I'm enjoying it in the one episode per week. And I have no clue what is going to happen. I think there's three more episodes or something. So I'm excited. It's something I look forward to every Friday.
I'm excited to watch this new episode. So non-spoiler for WandaVision, but in the storylines we've seen from Marvel Comics, Wanda is busted. Like, Wanda Maximoff, the Scarlet Witch, is just busted. Her powers are ridiculously vague, but she has done things from, oops, I killed all the Avengers in Avengers Disassembled, or not necessarily killed, but disabled, maimed, destroyed by herself because she was having a sad, to I got even more sad, so I kind of rewrote all of reality across every single plane of existence because I got sad, and created an alternate universe where mutants under the rule of Magneto ruled the world. Wanda is busted.
Yeah. So I mentioned, my exposure is mostly limited to the movies and then like the 90s animated cartoons with like Spider-Man and X-Men. But
glory days.
Yeah, she definitely seems like a league above most of the other characters power-wise.
And I'm kind of excited to see them playing around in that space. So it'll be interesting to see what winds up happening and coming out of this, especially as the next phase of Marvel Cinematic Universe starts to kick off. Well, sorry we didn't have a proper hot seat for the end of this one, but I thought it was just a little bit more fun to do something fun and geeky to finish out our episode today. If you have any thoughts or any other advice you would want to share about when you would wheel, or if you have any other questions about the intricacies of wheeling, we will do our best to try to help you out with it. You can feel free to leave a comment. You can add us on Twitter, where we are at GemstoneMindMTG. You can send us an email if you have a more long-form question. We are gemstonemindpodcast@gmail.com. Be sure to like and subscribe and hit that notification bell if you're watching on YouTube. And if you're not, why not just give us a watch on YouTube as well? I mean, we're so good, we're definitely worth listening to twice. Right, Jake?
Yes. Do it.
So we'll be taking next week to do another mini episode, but we'll be back again with a full-length audio episode in the next 2 weeks. Until then, I'm John.
And I'm Jake.
You can reach the crew from Gemstone Mine on Twitter at GemstoneMineMTG or send us an email at GemstoneMinePodcast@gmail.com. On YouTube, we're Gemstone Mine Podcast. Be sure to like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell.